a much larger amplitude. Those are the two bands here. But also an important thing is that it's really correlated. The two bands are correlated with each other. When one goes to lower energy, so extreme ultraviolet or optical, the amplitude of variability is much smaller. But now what's interesting is that also the amplitude of variability, this is actually not a very good graph for this, but just for illustration, which range I'm talking about. The amplitude of variability in GEV type range, in EGRET type range, is actually significantly smaller. It's really more like the amplitude that we observe in maybe in extreme ultraviolet or in optical. So this band seems to be linked to this one, whereas this band is linked to this. So that obviously implies that that is probably the same electron population that is responsible for the emission in both TEV and soft X-rays. And with that, one can actually this is a little aside here, but of course those objects are believed to be relativistically beamed towards us, that essentially the jet pointing close to our line of sight, and it's the variability of the gamma ray emission, assuming co-spatiality with X-rays on the basis of photon-photon pair production, that allows you to estimate the limit on the Lorentz factor of the jet, or this actually happens to be Lorentz factor convolved with the angle to the line of sight. So this, from the optical depth to pair production, produces a limit of at least 4 or so, and maybe as high as 8 of this factor delta, which is standard definition, essentially quite close to the value of Lorentz factor gamma. So with the spectral variability, one can actually make a reasonably simple assumption for a minute that is possible to test, is that the spectral variability that we see in X-rays, which appears to be, the amplitude of it appears to be increasing going towards harder X-rays, which is something that we of course expect to see in TEV band, but the sensitivity is not large, it's not good enough. That implies that most likely is due to the preferential energy losses of electrons as one goes towards higher energies. So from this, assuming basically that it is the synchrotron and or Compton losses, one can actually calculate the electron lifetime from the data, and then infer from that the Lorentz factors and magnetic field. But that, of course, can be done completely independently via the either Planck-Ishino limit or alternatively, essentially the same results are obtained by basically considering just energy conservation. That in order to produce a TEV photon, you have to have a TEV electron type thing. This is, again, only algebra and very much hand-waving, and I know Rosa probably smiles because this is something that many people have done in much greater detail with getting roughly the same results. So.
It's exactly the point that I think that it's an articulate dispersion power goes into doubly algebra without realizing the fundamental point is that the scattered photon is less than the electron that produces.
Exactly, right. So anyway, so with this, just to show you how the behavior of the spectrum looks like in comparison to the intensity of the flux, this is actually a little more than just the dependence on the amplitude of the variability in different bands. That's a function of intensity of the source. But anyway, if you fit now the spectrum of this Markarian 421 laser to a relatively simple power law, which is valid over a relatively short band of energies. In fact, in this particular case, it's a little more complicated. But to the zero approximation, this is correct. The source appears to become, as it increases in brightness, appears to become much harder. This is photon index, which essentially means that the spectrum is harder going up. It becomes harder first, and then it stays at a relatively hard level, relatively flat photon index as it continues getting brighter, and then at some point apparently the process of injection or acceleration ceases and the source becomes fainter, and in the process of becoming fainter it becomes soft first. And this is the kind of behavior that actually has been seen in a number of lasers, although I actually am not even completely convinced at the moment that this is something that really obeys kind of correlation in a global sense or even on a local, very small micro-variability type sense. And Paolo and I have many discussions here. This is actually one of the joys of this meeting, that one can actually converse about those different problems or different observational aspects in confront theory. But anyway, the soft lag, as we call it in our paper with Pat Takahashi, is something that can be estimated basically by the...
You're making sort of the point there, that behavior, it's true, is the opposite of what one might expect for sort of an impulsive shock acceleration or something like that, where you build up behind you, you know, you have some burst and you build up behind the electrons after you build up the...
Probably, yeah.
The low energy electrons. It's the rise, the increase
that you're referring to. I think that the increase is something that perhaps is less clearly borne by the data. It's the decay of the flags that we clearly see defined, that hard X-rays go away first and soft X-rays in the
That's more general, because having made the spectrum, then you'd expect the cooling to take over. But in terms of, if you could establish the first, that would be prescriptive about the particle acceleration.
I think that this
bottom up versus top down, as it were.
This is very, very important, very useful point that you're saying, because we actually have not gone through the data and clearly divided the rise versus fall and all that stuff. This is something that still will have to be done, but that's a very good point to try to on the basis of the behavior of the spectrum on the rising part of the flux, to establish what the spectrum looks like, what is the spectral change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly something that data should be able to tell us, because objects like this are sufficiently bright that we have enough data. But anyway, right now I'm going to be talking only about essentially radiative losses more than acceleration processes. And in fact, if the decay of the hard of the soft X-rays really does, if the decay of the flux of soft X-rays lags the flux in hard X-rays, one can actually combine the, this is basically a standard Radke and Lightman type formula for a half-life of electron with the Lorentz factor, gamma L in magnetic field B. Of course, everything modulus is Lorentz factor, which has to do with Bini. But completely independent, the standard simplification formula tells you that this is the case of two equations can be combined into one, and on the basis of that, we can actually infer what is at least the order of magnitude magnetic field. Paolo is laughing because they've seen this very huge. The magnetic field is on the order of a little less than a Gauss, and the electron Lorentz factor is on the order of 10 to the 6, on the order of million. So this is the kind of stuff now that is really quite nice, because we have a set of parameters. Now let's compare those to the essentially energy conservation type arguments, how to produce that are required to produce the TeV radiation. And again, this is somewhat didactic and tutorial. I'm sure that many of you have not seen it, but that you wrote yourself papers on the subject. So I just want to focus on the fact that it's roughly the same set of parameters that we're getting, that it's on the order of the electron Lorentz factors are on the order of 10 to the 6, and magnetic field, of course, follows from that. But the interesting thing is that it's not because of the Klein-Nishino limit, the peak of the distribution in the source, as you might have seen on one of the previous geographs, is of the synchrotron component is around extreme ultraviolet. It turns out it's probably not the extreme ultraviolet photons that are the peak photons for synchrotron self-compton. It turns out that Klein-Nishino implies that it's Rogers is waiting to say that. I'm just curious if you have anything to...
No,
very much looking forward to hear comments from you about it. But it's most likely those prime software photons that are really providing the seed for the compensation. And just along the lines of what Robert just mentioned, this is the quality of the data that we have in the latest campaign that was actually 1998, a year ago roughly, for the same Mark Aaron 4.1 object. But we do have well resolved rise and fall type peaks in the in the data. In fact, this is, I think, much nicer than the previous data, because here we can actually look at both the right increase and the decrease of flux. And I think it would be really quite interesting to see what's going on. And in fact, the XDE data which Sam is even analyzing is shown in a little greater detail here. And indeed, what happens is not just a gradual increase or whatever of the hardening of the spectrum, not just plotted some slightly different places in the opposite direction. But we actually see that the index seems to be going up and down on those short microvariability, whatever, during those brief events. So I think that would be really quite interesting. I think that the process of acceleration of particles here, as you pointed out, can be actually inferred. I just wanted to show you the paper that has been posted on the web today. This is something that I worked on with Eric Perlman, and we have another one of those objects, a southern source, so we don't know if it produces any TED emission or not. It's 2005-489, and we actually resolved very nicely this very long-lasting but relatively simple flare in this source, and we in fact see the same kind of behavior as before. This is plotted here, essentially a hardness ratio on the bottom, and you can see that the source becomes...
What are those three?
Those are three lighters in three different bands.
Yes. It's
2 to 5 kb, 5 to 10 and 10 to 15. Okay, I'm sorry, we probably should have done it maybe a little thicker line. But I think that what really is interesting is this, that again, in this particular case, this relatively simple flare seems to get hard first, then the flux continues going up, and then during the decay portion, it seems to be going down here. And this is probably the second flare that our data indicates, and I'm not sure if it may be in reality. One should only consider the data set up to here, because this implies that there is probably some kind of second event. One of the exciting things about those objects, completely independent of the radiative process, and this is just a little bit of a plug for some of you who might be interested in cosmology, is the fact that lasers can be used to search for hot intergalactic medium, and this is along the lines of the kind of stuff, again, sorry to confuse maybe some of you, but this is along the kind of stuff that Jerry Ostreicher and his collaborators were talking about. It's the fact that the lasers at intermediate redshifts, at redshifts of up to about 0.5 or so, provide very nice white light sources to try to search for the putative hot intergalactic medium that is supposed to be the form in which the missing baryons in the local universe are hidden. And it turns out that probably the range of the temperatures of that hot IGM is on the order of 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 Kelvin, which is actually ideal to search for them in the absorption, using the absorption in, since the resonant lines should be relatively strong, that the opacity of resonant lines is strong in oxygen, with primarily oxygen 7 and oxygen 8. Mm-hmm. And this is just an example. Of course, it's a simulation, it's not real data. To the aficionados, of course, it's not a PSA, but that means the same data. I wish that I could show this, but I hope that this is also a little bit of work for the upcoming observatories, XMM, Astro-E, and AXF, which are going up within the next 7 months. Hopefully we'll produce data that will either prove or disprove existence of such medium, which in any case would be very interesting. Okay, now let me switch gears and start talking about the other kind of active galactic nuclei, and here I will talk about the objects where we presumably observe relatively isotropic emission, where the observed high energy emission is really not dominated by the jet, but it really is something that we're seeing from the vicinity of the central source emitted essentially nearly uniformly, certainly not relativistically clean. This is a general picture of the spectrum of a radio quiet active galactic nucleus. This is something that Randy Fabian produced, but I think that it's identical to the way data looked like if there was a second viewgraph. I'll show it to you, but let me maybe actually use this instead of the other one. Since this is a little simpler, it contains almost all the components that are present in the other one, but not all of them. This is an object that many of you might have actually played with or used to actually work to test against or test this data against the models is IC43298. And this is an observation that Andrzej and I have done approximately 4 or 5 years ago or so. So this is just merely an illustration for what the broadband spectrum looks like, and this is essentially more didactic than essentially new results. But most of the active galaxies, the radio quiet active galaxies, they're certainly the low luminosity variety, the ones that are less than on the order of 10 to the 44 or so, have this primary power law that seems to be cut off roughly exponentially, and this is again something that is consistent with the data, but possibly not the best description of the data, that on the low energy end is absorbed by the host galaxy and possibly in some cases by some kind of ionized circumnuclear material. And this is something that is essentially of relatively less interest to the purpose of this talk, but the important part is that it's been discovered by the on the basis of the GINDA data that Ken Townsend collaborators and many other people, that the data essentially are not just well described by the power law, but have this additional hump, the so-called Compton reflection hump, which presumably arises from the primary photons illuminating some kind of cold material, which is best described as the material that might be powering the nucleus. So the whole picture is essentially holding together reasonably nicely. And the fact that this material is relatively cold is borne by the fact that one sees a pseudo-edge and also RMK alpha line, which of course implies the energy of that line implies relatively low temperature of the material. So this is presumably the signature of the accretion disk, but there is still some doubt if this is indeed the accretion disk. This might be material that is a little farther away from the central source. And in addition to that, of course, it's the relationship between the iron line and the reflection component that should tell us something about the central source. Of course, all this material is flowing onto the black hole, since I will return to this geograph a little later, this is actually something that in some sources, again, we can measure the mass of the central black hole. NGC 4258, of course, is the poster child, and I think that objects like this really will allow us to say something more about what's going on with those sources. Again, just briefly, the reflection component, the spectrum of the reflection component is actually angle dependent. Pavel Margus and Andrzej Ziarski have shown this in their paper a few years ago, and I think that actually has some important implications on something that we can on the inferences we can make about the geometry of the sources. Again, this is the observer's view of the theory of the central regions of radio quiet active galactic nuclei, and the cartoon here is simplistic and is probably incorrect. I would say that there's one aspect of it that I probably don't believe in, but just let me just go through it, and I'll show you what I actually think that might be not right. It's probably this cold accretion disk, which actually produces soft photons that are approximately on the order of 10 to the 5th Kelvin, somewhere between 5 and 30 electron volts, that illuminates regions of hot plasma. I call them clouds, but there might be magnetic loops, there might be some kind of additional hot corona, which is probably not uniformly covering the disk, but it's only covering the fraction of the disk. Of course, it's black hole accreting the material onto it, and that material locally produces soft photons, as I said, that then get upscattered via thermal compensation in the hot corona or those loops. And this material now produces the Hart power law that now in turn gets modified by the fact that the Hart X-rays also get Compton reflected from the cool accretion disk. So this is pretty much the quote-unquote standard picture that we're testing now. And I actually think that this is possibly a bit simplistic, and now the question is the region with hot plasma, the 10 to the 9 Kelvin plasma, really indeed above the accretion disk, or is it in the interior of it? And I think that question is something that probably will be answered by the more detailed observations and also theoretical work that Ross, you're nodding your head, so I wonder if you have any insight on this. The radiation, again, in very simplest way, the radiation processes with the absence of the annihilation line really imply that plasma is probably thermal, and probably has a temperature on the order of 100 KeV, maybe a little more than that. And that has to do with the fact that there's essentially no annihilation line. Roger.
Yes. Would you like to also see the picture? In the interest of making solid progress,
okay.
Do you think it's almost impossible that corona could be filled with a pair plasma?
Completely with a pair plasma.
Well, I mean, so that essentially all the half left on the feet.
No, I think that what's probably excluded is pair plasma with very high Lorentz factors. I think that relatively low Lorentz factors of pair plasma are probably still okay. That's something that Andrei probably is much more than
really, it's not a favored model at the moment. But I'm wondering if you can actually sort of rule that out on economics like that.
No, I mean, I would say to judge off of it, that if the plasma is purely thermal, which means low Lorentz factors, it has to be electrons because balancing pairs against pair population against pair insulation gives you negligible pair density. You cannot really make those pairs. But if you add some tails, like, you know.
Yeah, no, it's just saying.
Then you can produce enough pairs to make it still looking thermal but made of pairs. So,
same thing, you mean you think you can probably rule out.
Well,
I think you misunderstood assigning my question. If you can rule out a pair plasma being essentially the dominant.
No, I cannot.
You cannot?
No, I cannot. I can. If I make assumption that it's purely thermal, I can rule it out. But if I have tails, I cannot. I can have easily per colony.
But you think it's mostly. It could be mostly pairs still?
Yes.
But those, from what I gathered, those pairs cannot be all primarily very hot. It cannot be just hot pairs. Isn't that correct, Andrei?
The exponential cutoff from going
It can be, everything can be pairs. The problem is that if we take parameters of those sources, temperatures and optical depths, and if you make standard pair balance calculations as Roland has done in 84, then we get require extremely high compactness parameters that seem unlikely. But if we then modify those calculations by adding a small tail that may contain 1%.
That's quite reasonable.
And then this tail can easily produce enough pairs, so everything is per plasma. And this also will be completely compatible with data because the main scope of scattering is still done by the thermal component, and the tail would only show up possibly in compared data or some
individual
data in the future. And I think Paolo would agree with it.
Okay. And you don't expect to see an annihilation line?
No, in thermal plasma, basically, annihilation line is always invisible, even 100% thermal plasma.
Yeah, but you say it cannot be.
Well, but this is such a small tail that still most of the pearls that annihilate, most of the pearls, 99-point-something pearls in that picture, are still thermal and they annihilate and they don't give any tail. And only this very small fraction would possibly give you something.
That's why I also did IC43 trying to name with a pure transfer model and it's fine.
But you're not
dilation, you can have there's a little dip before the annihilation feature and the data is bad enough in OPTI for that one.
Yeah.
Well, but we cannot do it with NGC for
transistors. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, IC structure is not so nice object, but in the case of NGC for 51, we can show that the dominant component is certainly thermal, and you can constrain on thermal component to be less than, well, in this case, less than 10%.
But when you have good enough data, then you can rule it out. But in fact, it seems that there are like maybe one or two other objects like 4151. Everything else looks like IC4328 with a cutoff that's higher. So there might be two classes for C6 or one which is higher than the other one, 4151, which looks like the hard state, the black hole.
Another complication for drama.
Well, I think the answer to our discussion is that we absolutely know nothing. It could be an entirely non-thermal threshold.
I don't think you can be entirely non-thermal.
Well, but you just said that you could fit everything except for 4151.
Well, there are probably some other cases you can't fit. IC49, 4329 is a really high cutoff.
Higher the cutoff, worse the data, the problem.
Yeah.
Things will probably get a little bit better if we should believe Maxima from Sage's optimism with the hard X-ray detector on Astro E, which supposedly goes to 700 keV and has low background. But we'll see. I think that we're fighting very hard even early on in the observation program to try to put few decent observations of sources that actually will have and will produce some good data. But anyway, one thing that is somewhat surprising about some of those sources is the fact that of course, many of you probably have heard Antipodean advertising extensively MCG-6315 as having the broad and disc-like iron line. This is iron K line, of course, which comes from the reflection of the cold material accreting from the black hole. And of course, the big question is this ubiquitous? Can we actually say something about the nature of the of safers in general, that all of them have this X-ray emission coming within few gravitational radii, and can we actually say something about the nature of the spin of the black hole, or is it something that is maybe unique to few sources? And I think that, of course, data of this quality require extremely long observations and require, therefore, objects that are really quite bright to reduce the length of those observations. And in fact, there are a couple other sources that the line appears to be looking like that. But my favorite source, IC43298, the one that again I have shown you before, appears to show an iron line that does not have that right wing. And this is the overall electromagnetic spectrum, which is essentially entirely consistent with what we've seen before with the Rosa-Ginga data. But the looking at the summed ASCA spectrum from all the observations and adding XD spectrum to constrain the overall shape of the continuum implies that this line really is not broadened relativistically the same way as few of the other active galactic nuclei have it. By the way, those are the two sources where I actually do believe now that the line might have a red wing. It's NGC-3516, which is the source that has been really extensively observed, but that's the subject of this monitoring campaign for the search of the break in the power density spectrum. And 3783, which is an object which is also extensively observed with ASCA. So I think that those three...
The spectral indices of those sources?
No. I actually analyzed those sources myself, so I would be able to get those for you within a matter of hours.
How come that the 3227 is equal to 3783?
I think that this is the 3227 is a mistake.
I'm reassured.
Now you really should. Looks like you're paying attention. I'm glad to hear that. But anyway, just coming back to the issue of the red wings and iron lines, I think that it's very difficult to. It's relatively easy to see clear red wings, but it's difficult to actually rule them out because you can always have a wing at some level. Here, what we did here is we have this combined data. And we essentially zeroed out the line and plotted the residuals here. And this looks extremely confusing and very busy and stuff like this. But this is actually for an observer, one can really assess the absence of anything at approximately 5 keV or below in terms of the residuals. So this line really here has to arrive at significantly larger distance from the central source than what one would expect in MCG6. So this has to be on the order of, I think that now we have probably even tighter limits on the order of 30 to 40.
How sensitive is the continuum model effect, like if XD is messed up and drives it? Because you can get rid of the tail really easily.
Yes, we actually have done that very carefully with just doing the ASTA data and then doing the XDE by itself, allowing, in fact, we this observation is something that Pavia and maybe you have some interest in. This observation clearly implies that XP and ASCA are really miscalibrated with respect to each other, and it's not that somebody's messing up on the calibration. The issue here, and Omar of course is probably feeling completely broken down because this has been a frustration about the last year, that XPE people who are actually calibrating XPE claim that they understand the instrument well enough that they are confident that their calibration is good, whereas everybody else assumes that the data or the observations published, again, is the crab that is the calibrator for its transponders.
So what is the difference in terms of
index? The index is about 1, it's on the order of 1/10, it's in fact written here. It's, in this particular case, 0.12, but there might be, this is maybe not a very robust statement. It has to do with the fact that the data are not strictly simultaneous. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, again, must be.
I think it's both.
So, in fact,
Ginga
is consistent with
us? Yeah,
Ginga
seems to be
consistent. Yeah, Ginga is consistent with us, and both of them are probably wrong. There is more and more indication of the fact that I believe that SCE has been done from ground up trying to do this performance experiment to find out what is the index of the craft, among others. And I think that instead of fudging the data and tweaking all the parameters in your response matrix to make it fit the canonical index of the craft, the XP people actually learn. But that's the reason why there's still a discrepancy between the two, because neither, you know, you can't really erase papers from 1973, yet at the same time you cannot say that your measurements are wrong when you really perform them three times and they're consistent with each other.
So Ginga was first up.
A what?
Ginga. People of Ginga first.
Yes, Ginga was fudged, yeah. Ginga was fudged, GIS was fudged, SIS was fudged, everybody was, because people basically don't need their own detectors well enough, you know, if somebody has performed the measurement, and you know, the error bars were relatively large on this. Anyway, this is maybe something that many of you who like precision of three significant digits really might dislike about observers that we just don't have in our reduction order.
How about this precision?
And the same with SARS,
Sorry? I think that's going to change because I think ACSAF has been calibrated to the sufficient accuracy to resolve this question. So I think that it's a matter of waiting for a few more months.
So what about SATs?
I don't know anything about SATs. I never analyzed SATs.
Well, SATs agrees with Ginga.
I think SATs was also calibrated.
It agrees with
XP. Wasn't calibrated by CRAB also?
I don't know. I'm just asking you.
Do you have a follow-up?
And Rosa
pushed that they took the crowd spectrum.
Well, Rosa was not calibrated, period. I mean, Rosa, there's some very simplistic measurements for Rosa, but there is no calibrator, you know, below 2 keV on its side, so we cannot cross-check.
And Exosat was not calibrated?
Exosat was calibrated myself. Exosat and Ginga agreed quite well, I think. And
again, I'm just. Agrees with Ginga, but SAS
disagrees
with
XSAS
because
SAS
doesn't
teach all
X-ray stuff.
So
this is incredibly
frustrating. Yeah, it really is. But in a sense, it's the physics of X-ray detection that really makes it so difficult.
And do you think that is going to change with the next generation with XNN and Astro-V?
It spent $50 million, if my numbers are right. Andrew probably knows more than I do on calibration.
So a lot of time anyway.
Oh no, it's excellent spectroscopy. You've got CDs and you've got ratings.
I was under the impression that SMM and Astro-E were the real. But we're not going to be able to trust their
so you can get right points of course.
Well, their matrices will get probably tweaked up to agree with
that. Even the calibration quality depends on the amount of money spent.
Right, this is to the first order of the universe.
Could you just show the IC42 and the nano spectrum again?
The overall broadband?
No, the last one you have. The one you have behind it.
You mean this one?
Yeah. If you look at the data, it looks like it is significantly offset from the straight line of about 5.5 kV.
Right here,
yeah. But you're saying that's not, you're saying you can explain that completely in the Gaussian, yeah. The Gaussian wings of a narrow line.
Right, and Gaussian line with, I don't remember exactly what the values, I probably have it somewhere here, but it's on the order of 200 eV sigma, explains it very well, and in fact there's absolutely no improvement no matter what kind of skewed line or disk line you want to add to the data. And in fact, I think Gaussian is just about the best fit if you do the simultaneous fit between the two instruments. But it's really quite surprising. Mm.
But given the noise in the data, there could be some significant plots out there, I guess.
Well, again, one has to have a model to be able to determine how much. Sure. And in principle, one could add a narrow component with some kind of arbitrary signal to a broad component and put a limit on the gravitational redshift of the component. So. But I think that one, at least this is something that in principle is feasible, and this is a very preliminary result on the subject. Since we know that at least for the standard solar abundances, what should be the equivalent width of the fluorescent line coming from a cold medium, one in principle can play the following game, that if we know, of course, the amount of reflection is very tightly correlated or coupled with the angle of the reflector with respect to the line of sight, and this is something that I guess I showed before, but it's the work that Andrzej and Pavel had done some time ago. So in principle, you cannot tell how much reflection do you have unless you know the angle. But if you now perform a fit to both the line and the reflector, and you assume that both arise on the same medium, which of course is an assumption, one could in principle, by knowing the equivalent width of the line, in principle one should determine what is the solid angle of the reflector is now subtending to the central source, and in a case like this, one could in principle determine what is the inclination of the disk. And this is something that we have done for this. So this is preliminary. This there probably will be more careful analysis of this data. But I think that this source really seems to be appearing to be on the order with cosine of the inclination of the order of about 0.3. So this is essentially something that is more of an idea of a test type thing that
how far is 0.3?
Yeah.
So inclination is 70.
Yeah. So it's relatively inclined source, which implies that the line with that kind of inclination, the line really should see the relativistic effect in the dark. So that makes even that much stronger of a constraint. On the other hand, the equivalent width can be a little less, and because of the fact that some of the line can be right in farther away, so that's not a very tight limit, I think.
What's the plus sign?
The plus sign?
Yeah, that's a cross.
Oh, this one, that happens to be the best fit, but that means nothing because it's essentially the same quality of a fit over the entire banana. So the error bars really, this is I believe chi-square was 2.3.
This is a typical safe with one. This is inclined in 75 degrees, so that would be...
Right, that's the point. That's the reason why I think that there is a very good... Well, 75 degrees doesn't certainly mean that there's anything wrong with the can be safe with one.
No, safe with one is also, 30 degrees.
Yeah, so the argument here can be made that... Sorry?
Well, for example, there is this paper by Nandreitel or Jane Turner, whoever, who fitted Oscar data during time to its 30 degrees.
Key word here.
Yeah.
Do
you hear skating
phrases?
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that your point is well taken, that a substantial fraction of the line, or at least some fraction of the line, can be rising farther away from the central source, in which case the limits are really... This, I'm really only suggesting that this is possible. I'm not saying that in this particular case, or it's feasible because of the fact that it's easy to produce the iron line. It's harder to produce reflection. You have to have a lot more column. You have to have two orders of magnitude more column, roughly, or whatever. Greg?
I've seen some papers lately speculating on very large iron abundances, and I think they tend to be secret one, narrow line secret ones. Is that a pattern first that they have very strong iron emission?
I think that the narrow line seabird one is a beast of really quite different color, and I think that those objects are really quite poorly understood. But I think that they certainly imply, because of the fact that there are some iron complexes that are seen in emission in those sources, they probably do have excess iron abundance over other sources. And I think many people are, and the Fabian in fact talks about 630-15 as having twice solar abundance, if I remember correctly. I haven't seen the paper yet, but I think it presented at the conferences. So that certainly would explain that maybe the inclination of the disk is not quite 7 degrees. I think that the point that Andre raised, and the other effect that you're bringing up here really going the same direction that seems to produce the line is just to tweak the iron abundance curve, as you know.
Is it relatively linear?
Not quite. It's more complicated than that, because the reflection component also is non-linear. That affects in spectral fits the intensity of the line. So things are, it's not just merely non-linear, it goes even further than that. It's there's a lot of coupling between spectral fitting components in addition to the nature of the way the spectrum would look like instead of a perfect detector. So
the line strength goes by square root of abundance curve.
Yeah, roughly.
That's empirical.
Yeah, empirical, not based.
But one thing that is worth showing here, and this is something that I think hopefully will tell us a little more about the geometry of the sources, that this is not the first time that we've seen this, but something that I actually haven't heard elucidated all that much, that whenever there are observations of objects where variability is seen, and IC43298 is certainly a variable, this is, by the way, the light curve of it, and it went up and down only by about from about 40 to 60 of its units of the count per second, so it's not that much of the variability. But those objects seem to have a relationship between the spectrum and the intensity in saturation. That when the object gets brighter, the spectrum gets softer. And this is precisely what we have seen in the paper that you might have seen on your local web here in NGC5548. So this probably tells us something about the geometry of the source, and I think that I have not really thought about it really thoroughly enough to really convince myself that some parameters can be excluded versus others. But this is a behavior that is pretty common in the bona fide C1 galaxies, and there are 2 to 10 kV emission. Now I'm completely excluding the quote unquote soft excess, which is something that I promised I will not talk about. And mind you that this is just as a complete aside, that this is exactly the opposite behavior from lasers. What we see in my panel for 21 would be like this. When the source is bright, it's hard. Here, when the source is bright, it's soft. So it's interesting, and that in itself maybe tells us something about
this is something against what, Raph? I don't know.
And this is essentially, this is flux against spectrum. Soft, hard, and bright.
Okay.
Sorry, it's not very, very clear. Well, yeah, the parameters, it turns out that it's, again, a preliminary plot, but
is it the straight line a very good fit to that?
Sorry?
I think the straight line is a very good fit to that.
This kind of straight line?
Yeah,
but this is preferred.
Yeah, okay.
Could you show the axis of what is that?
You want to know what is the index,
right?
Yes. So it's
0.2
million. Yeah, but it's significant.
Yeah, it is significant.
Yeah, it's not the only object that's been seen.
Yeah, it's been seen for, you know, at least about 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years maybe. Yeah, I think the next set seen, I think it was seen in NGC41. Yeah. All right, in last few minutes, let me just switch gears a little bit and tell you about something that I have been working on recently, and that's again work in progress, but one of the things that we have an opportunity to study with HPE, with its very good response, you probably have seen this picture many times, with its response to all the way up to 30 or so KeV, is that we can actually study the spectra of heavily absorbed sources, and in fact, in the context of this unification model, you see favorite one when you're looking close to the axis of the central of the symmetry of the system, and when you're looking close to the plane of the accretion disk or the putative torus, you actually would be classifying the source of the super too. So that's a pretty straightforward and standard type.
What is holding this torus in as a torus? We had long discussions here earlier in the program.
I actually am getting more and more convinced that the torus might or might not exist, but the question is how optically thick it is. Maybe this is just merely a warped accretion disk, as Ms. Begerman would like it. I don't know. I think that one of the questions that we wanted to answer with the observational monitoring of the flux of the source is what kind of optical depth we
see. The hypothesis is the force of pure thought or something.
Volanda.
Roger.
Yeah, it could be. And in fact, I think that there is something that some of the observation evidence here probably will support your point of view. Again, in a case of the sort of just very briefly.
You can observe pure thought.
All I was saying was it was a problem to support the torus, which was fully recognized by Krovic and Beagleman and other people who'd written on it. And that's not a problem for warp disks, although they may have other problems that you get the same sort of effect with a warp disk.
I actually will argue that if torus exists, it probably has to be relatively low optical depth. On the basis of variability. Yeah. You already can see the line of argument that will be coming up. But this is the source that that Chris Dawn, myself, and Dave Smith looked at with OSCE, and we combined it, the OSCE observation is here with all the Ginga data and added an ASCAP. None of this is simultaneous. To infer that in the case of this source, it might well be a very strong hard X-ray emitter, and in fact it was. The OSCE data implied that it's the second brightest hard X-ray source on its sky, the isotropic favored galaxy on its sky after NGC 4151. So this was a very nice little discovery, and we went after that.
Sorry, you put that back?
Sure. This is not simultaneous data, so the quality is low, but go ahead.
What is the interpretation of...
This is, by the way, not mu f mu.
No, I understand.
This is f mu.
Yeah.
Okay.
But still, what is the interpretation of the hard X-ray component?
Of this?
Yeah.
Presumably, this source, in fact, interpretation here is as simple as IC4329A being seen through some kind of heavy absorption.
So there's a component that it has a low energy cutoff due to a high column density.
Correct. Which is this component.
Yes. And that would be is it supposed that is a Comptonized spectrum that is processed in this way?
It's probably the same spectrum.
With a cutoff of 100 or 200 kV.
Yes, that's right. We actually are not showing the cutoff here, but the data again was...
The data are not going to come to
right.
So except if you look at those five points.
There's a very good chance that there is some miscalibration of OSCE here, and this is something that that the OSCE team basically cannot commit themselves to that being significant or not significant.
So the error bars don't include calibration.
That's right, there's no systematic errors included in this range. So We basically think of this, and I really probably shouldn't be plotting that many data points. It should be really the data should group in reality.
Yeah, grouping data would show greatly on the visual spectrum.
Right. thank you.
Yeah. And then let me ask, what is the lower energy X-ray component? What is that thought to be?
Very good question. This is in fact a source which has probably two separate components of the low energy spectrum. It's certainly a starburst galaxy, so we can actually model this low-energy component as the diffuse emission due to the multiple...
So this is a scattered part.
It's a scattered, but we have to be careful. It's a combination of the scattered component plus starburst component, which we cannot resolve spatially.
So it ought not to vary at all.
That's correct, and in fact has not been observed to vary. So it can be this scattered component here,
plus an intrinsic starburst.
Plus starburst, which is farther out.
What is starburst temperature?
Probably on the order of one stage, you can say it's a supernova remnant type, type temperature. I think, but it turns out that Chris and I have an observation of the source of ASHA, which is exactly the kind of thing that will allow you to throw out all the stardust nonsense and try to go after the stardust component. And ASHA is made for observations like this.
Yeah.
And that will allow us, since you are already focusing on this, this will allow us to basically establish the true ratio of this to determine what is the fraction of the stardust component to say something about the nature of the stardust medium.
Right.
What's the spectral index of the lower energy?
Of the lower energy. Yeah. Yeah. This is poorly fitted. It turns out that ASCA beam is so large that the spectral index here, this is really badly fitted, but it's comparable to what this. It's certainly within errors. But there appear to be some kind of complexes at the low energy that imply that there is a thermal contribution to that.
What about what number?
The index on the order of photon index 2, energy index of 1.
So it's not that if you just saw the, if you just had up to 10 kV,
right?
So you hadn't observed beyond 10 kV, could you tell that spectrum from a radioactive galaxy, say a supernova?
No, you probably would not even call it an active galaxy because it can be equally well fitted by hot plasma, by combination of multi-temperature hot plasma. That's the problem. So one of the things that is really quite interesting in this source is that it has a booming bright iron line. The iron line has equivalent width upon the order of a keV.
Well, that suggests it's not just a starburst then, right? Doesn't it?
Well, that's...
There's obscuration.
That has
equivalent width unless you are blocking.
It's the 1 keV broad equivalent width iron line that really made people realize, something interesting. This is just too high. You cannot possibly produce it in any kind of standard scenario. So this line presumably is coming from the standard medium. So again, the diagnostics of this, and I hope that in another 18 months...
Could you just ask a question? I'm sure I ought to know the answer to it, but I found it. When you get that absorption, as you see, starting at about 20 keV,
right.
Which particular element dominating the absorption?
It's iron.
It's always iron.
It turns out that abundance of iron is so high in comparison to other elements above iron.
Yeah.
That the
you could forget everything above iron.
Nickel's marginally important.
Well, nickel maybe, yeah. What about zinc? Is that important enough?
Very low.
So it's basically
great stuff, you know, more about the relative abundance that one sees in absorption and intervening systems, but
for all cold absorption in this KH, you can just use iron or this iron group.
Yes,
nothing else.
To the best of my knowledge,
T-3 or whatever.
Right.
Okay.
But again, in fact, like maybe do this. This is new data, and this is truly simultaneous because it's just one satellite.
Yeah.
Comment is the fact that this is something that is really a little difficult to measure precisely, having to do also with the fact that the solid angle of TCA and the XE instrument and ASCA is different. So this is exactly the kind of observation that I should be doing. So in this particular case, we'll be able to tell to what extent this is coming from starburst and to what extent it's coming from the scattering medium. So this will be a diagnostic of the scattering.
So basically the shape of that model over there gives you the coordinates pretty accurately.
That's right, but in reality
it modulo the solar abundance and then
right.
You've got the product of the solar.
Well, I'm glad that you're leading on to my next.
Does anything even come close? Because if you're going to start talking about 5 times solar abundance, which some of these papers are, you can then start mucking around with the relative proportions of the ions. If there's anything,
turns out that
you come close.
The level of absorption is so severe that you essentially at any time see at the most 2 elements typically. It's either iron and say silicon sulfur, maybe iron and oxygen. Mm-hmm. Then once oxygen starts dominating, you have the column.
Oh, that's a low energy. I understand that.
Right,
at the high energy.
That's right. The column is so high due to iron that at this point you the contrast that well, essentially there are no photons anymore.
But there's no higher Z element that comes even close to contributing to the opacity with phosphorus and nickel.
Not that I know of. I don't think so. I understand very well what it's in reference to the conversation we had yesterday. In other words, is there any other way?
I think it's more generally, it's a very good, very question, because if you can argue that on very general ground, then measuring these, which is the data that's coming, will give you very good, but more than columns. I mean, you should get the shape right because of the absorption profile upside down, more or less.
There are methods to really go after the relative abundances of elements, but it really has to do with combining optical and X-ray.
You don't expect to see any more ridges above iron, basically.
No.
The fact that the accuracy will be, there's nothing to look at.
No. I mean, nickel is almost
the same. Nickel is the same, essentially, yes.
There's essentially no element that I can think of that would discomfort.
Okay, that sounds reasonable, yeah.
It's the combination of basically the relative abundances and the Z, which covers the sum. Yeah. All right. Anyway, so one of the things that given the fact that the subject is a mega maser, we would like to determine is what is really the intrinsic flux of the source. And you probably remember I showed this. This little cartoon from the cover of Nature magazine, and number one object always makes the cover, but number two object is buried on page 16, so this is NDC 4945, that Lincoln Greenhill has observed nearly as elegant, doesn't have that nice Cassorian distribution of megamaser spots. But still, the observations, as good as they were, and again, Andrew is probably as much of an expert on this as anybody else, the observations indicate that the mass of the central black hole, given the nature of the data, is probably on the order of 10 to the 6 solar masses. So this is actually quite different than NGC 4258. We have a factor of 30 lighter black holes here in this object. And that would imply that it's actually, if anything, this source might consume be a little different. Anyway, one of the things that we decided to do is to try to study the variability of the hard X-ray flux in it. And the variability, so the purpose, the goal of observing the variability in the source would be if we see large amplitude variability that goes all the way down essentially almost to zero, which is what we do, it would imply that we can pretty much exclude the source being entirely shrouded by the cocoon of constant thick matter, or at least a disk, or alternatively, and I'll show it to you in a cartoon.
So what
the idea here is, we want to know, let me just show two different scenarios.
Could you just say what is the Eddington luminosity? I'm not sure.
I'll come to that in a minute, okay? Let me show two different scenarios. In one case, when the source is really shrouded by relatively large solid angle work of the torus, since you had many discussions on the subject of that, you would expect that any kind of variability that you would observe from the source would be smeared up, simply because of the fact that there are many paths of the photons getting constant scattered or Thompson scattered in this absorber, bringing light back to the line of sight and therefore showing essentially no modulation in the flux, even if the central source is variable. On the other hand, if you see variability that goes up and down with relatively large relative amplitude, that would imply that X-rays that are produced, hard X-rays that are produced in the central source that are variable, essentially would have relatively low probability of being scattered back into the line of sight. So there are two consequences here. On one hand, if most of the absorption really occurs in some kind of relatively small solid angle as seen by the central source, it means that you can easily infer the luminosity of the central source. If this were the case, you don't know how many photons are really coming in, scattered back, and you could, in principle, do this, but it's much easier if you see this large amplitude variability, and you can actually choose this particular scenario, and again, this in the case of this source.
Just to be clear, Greg, the light curve you plotted was for 8 to 30 KeV.
Correct.
So this is in this sort of this is in the region where you have that heavy cutoff.
Right.
This is
right.
So the question is whether the photons that you're seeing are varying are actually absorbed photons or not. Or what they might be dominated by a complete.
I believe that all the photons that you're seeing here are the photons that manage to go through the absorber unabsorbed, unscattered.
But at 30 kV you've got, is there much absorption at 30 kV at the upper end of the band?
Well, that's the point, that what I'm actually plotting here is the slats of the 8 to 30 kV band, but at 30 kV there's a lot of tungsten absorption.
Tungsten scattering, right, yeah. I see, so it's
basically all the photons are essentially either you see them or they got scattered away. Nothing gets, it's unlikely that the photon light is scattered twice back towards the line of sight. I don't know.
Right, so the Thompson depth is an order unity, is that?
The Thompson depth inferred on the basis of the cutoff is probably 3. It's 4 times 10 to the 24, it's on the order of 3 times.
Right, so you're going to have that Thompson effect even at the.
Tau Thompson on the order of 3, 4 times 10 to the 24. Anyway, so in a case like this, I'm making an inference here that we essentially do not see any. I know Jean-Pierre is waiting impatiently for my.
Absolutely not.
Not for the end of the talk, for the value, for the. So basically my inference here is that the absorber, the column, and the disk is probably really confined, or the absorber is confined to relatively thin, geometrically thin structure. It's really not relatively high in terms of the vertical physical height. In a case like this, we can actually infer, and this is probably what's most interesting in reference to the finder. This is, after all, a conference about black holes, so what we can in principle do is by going through the set of argumentation, we can actually determine what is the Eddington ratio for this source. And if we now assume that we're not seeing any photons rescattered back into the line of sight, we can go back, use the column that we see, the cutoff that we see, as an indication of the Thompson depth, and therefore go back and calculate what is the true flags that we would see without any absorption in the line of sight and infer luminosity from this. With a luminosity of being of 10 to the 43 Earth per second, which is what the data say, and in the very worst case, maybe with solar abundance of twice solar, that would go now, since the Thompson depth in the line of sight would drop, that would go maybe by factor of 2. Down, we have the comparison of NGC 4945 against 4258. That in one case, which is Jean-Pierre Lasada's paper, the Eddington ratio was about 3 times 10 to minus 4, made on the order of.
It was not my paper, it was observations.
But I think that you made the inference that it's given here. In the case of NGC 4945, I think that it's pretty clear that the Eddington ratio is. Given the 10 to the 6 solar mass of the black hole is much higher. So this is actually that
was the X-ray luminosity.
Right, but
we did a volumetric correction of 10 to go to the ultraviolet.
Not for objects of that low of the luminosity. No, it's on the order, the volumetric correction is no more than 5 of 2.
Typically in low luminosity sieverts.
Yes, low luminosity sieverts.
Are we absolutely sure about that?
That's a good question.
Yes. But all of them are in fact absorbed along the other line.
Yeah. No, they cannot be. You mean all the low luminosity of these sorts?
Well, the low luminosity gets absorbed.
Lewis Hall has been writing about it recently, and he seems to agree with what you're saying.
Who was sorry?
Lewis Hall.
Yeah. Oh, Lewis Hall.
Yeah. Low luminosity about the broadband spectrum and low luminosity objects.
And you
can explain that they have relatively low UV. In relation to the
they're more efficient X-ray emitters. Low luminosity sources are more efficient. I think that this is not necessary. Probably his work is really very thorough, but I think that it's pretty much known on the basis of work of Andrew Lawrence and Martin Elvis and probably even some of the work that you have done ages ago. But yeah, low luminosity sources seem to be efficient X-ray emitters.
So that would only have to be bumped up by a factor of 2 or 3, maybe.
So there's still some uncertainty. Again, the iron abundance allows you. There's some uncertainty. Again, the volumetric correction is uncertainty. But I think that this is it, this is not going to be 10 to minus 4. And it's not going to be 70% probably.
Yeah.
It might be as much as 30, maybe as much as 3, but I think that, again, this is a bit of a hand-waving question. But I think that we have a case of a sorcerer, and I, in my modest opinion, this is really the only higher income racial source that we know of.
Christmas God season is exactly similar.
The credit was $10.68.
You get that envelope in the credit and that's the whole person to
the whole. Oh, you can do the same thing as $10.68, of course, but here is the direct
national. But what about oxygen?
Yeah, but there you see the x-rays are also obscured exactly the same way as in 45, and the ratio of luminosity is 20%.
What? Yeah, I'm a little worried about Cercinus. The Cercinus, you don't know if the Cercinus is still active.
Yeah.
You might be seeing a glow from distant material in Cercinus. Nobody has ever observed any variability for it.
Yeah, then it's a huge luminosity. It's that, well,
yeah.
The dead remnant luminosity is still.
But that, I agree. We do have an observation of Cercinus that right now is being put on hold. I thought that Andrew will have the actual observation, but
gave it up.
No, Cercinus, I will do Cercinus.
Oh, so you do have Cercinus?
That would be interesting.
I thought that, okay, I misunderstood.
Well, Centaurus.
Oh, great, so we'll work on that. When AXA gets launched, we want to do the observation simultaneously. Because that's the right thing to do, just in case, who knows, the object turns on. It certainly could not have turned off all that long time ago if it's still, if it's off. But anyway.
I'm really that 1068 is the greatest discovery.
Yes, 1068
is. And also it's amazing, so what remains of the
so. Yeah, but the case of 1068 is that we don't see the
yeah, it's reduced.
And half Eddington, 1068 is a risky source to work with because it's also higher luminosity.
Oh, sure.
Right, that's the luminosity series, near infrared.
Right.
20 microns.
And it's also a starless source, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is a starless source, but people think they can separate the nucleus from the starburst.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is pretty much all I have, and I know that I probably dumped a lot of information pertaining to lasers, Sacred 1, Sacred 2, some stuff like this, but my feeling is that I just wanted to basically to have you, without even having a summary, sheet summary bibliography, is that X-ray astronomy, really, especially the X-ray astronomy in hard X-rays, is really producing a lot of fantastic results, the stuff above, and the EXD is a really great instrument. But the frustration of many of you and Andrew is probably the prime flight bearer for the frustrating ones in terms of the miscalibration of the satellite is very valid, I think. But at the same time, at some point we're pushing the instrument sufficiently far that the calibration might actually tell us that the previous instruments are all maybe incorrect, and that's a really tall order to say and to basically we have to stand up to it. So that's the reason why the frustration of the observers is there, because we would have published the data a long time ago, if not the time.
Well, if you interpolate LC data to our energies for 49.45, do you get the same number, 7%, or? Because this is based on XT data.
No, this is based on XT, UOC, everything. It's all the same, Of course, the object varies, but so I'm taking some kind of mean plot here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, RC and XTE is in fact where the luminosity that quoted is actually broadband is 2 to 100 dB.
In the first viscosity, you see that the rover has to be thin because it's got ionization cones and radiation is going up. Do you see that 49, 45?
I actually don't know if there are. Andrew, again, you know more about
it. Not a spectacular ionization of 49.5, not like Cercinus. In fact, it's 49.5 looks in the optical region to the nucleus where we're in the circle.
We want to
call it, we better call it an active galaxy.
More heavy, more heavy.
We want to draw lines for carbon.
Yeah, I don't. The lines are like 1,000 kilometers per second in the
optical plane. We line a light spectrum of the nucleus. On an image, you don't see any part of the images.
Okay, that's right. Well, Cercinus, by the way, is also a subject of class 3 guaranteed targets. Cercinus is 49.45 is, and this is 1068 is, and IC4398. So. But I want to still advertise class 3 as a really important instrument, because the energy resolution of 10 eV will really tell us what's going on. Mm-hmm.
stable down and so on and so forth. We'll have a lot of new great data.
Well, the nice thing is that there would be a calibrated instrument flying at the same time.
I mean, only these things.
So is up for E.
I mean, well, no, it's too fast.
That's very true.
Yeah, because I think you'll be able to calibrate against center, I think. That's the hope, isn't it?
And the old satellites retrospectively.
Okay. Thank you very much.